Okay, so last time we left off in the Kuzari, the philosopher is trying to present his position about God and religion to King Bulan, who's seeking the proper path of proper service based on his dream that was visited, where he was visited by an angel in the dream, holding him, Kavanascha Ritsuya, your intentions are desirable but not your deeds. And therefore he goes and asks the philosopher. The philosopher tells him that God has no desire, God has nothing that he dislikes or likes. Because if God likes or dislikes, that means he has certain human characteristics, and God is too perfect. God is above, you know, human characteristics, and he certainly is lacking for nothing. And the only way that a person or a being can desire or dislike something is if that person has deficiencies. If I want something and I don't have it, then I'm deficient in some way. If I dislike something and I have that thing, then I'm deficient until I jettison the thing that I dislike from my purview. So God is neither. You know, God can't have any likes or dislikes. He's too elevated and perfect for that. And the next thing that we're going to see is another principle within philosophy describing the impossibility of God of having any knowledge of what is going on in a temporal, in a time-based universe. So that's what we're going to read about in paragraph 8 on page 49. And again, just in case you're coming in here for the first time, this is not what Judaism believes. Okay? So let me make sure you understand. We're at a point in the Kuzari where we're representing the position of the philosopher who, according to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, is antithetical to Judaism. So I don't want you to go home at the end of this year today and say, this is what we believe as Jews. Okay, so this is the philosopher's position. Paragraph 8, we need a reader. Volunteers. Please.
Furthermore, philosophers believe that God is too elevated to know the details of this world. This is so because all events that occur in this world are temporal, and God exists outside of temporality. God then never acquires any new knowledge, and so has no knowledge of you, and certainly does not know about your intentions or actions. Of course, then, God does not hear your prayers or see your movements.
Okay. So God cannot know of anything that exists in a time-based reality. The very fact that we are time-based means that we are so distant from God's reality. God cannot insert himself or will not insert himself in temporal existence because perfect beings have nothing to do with temporality. It's two planes of existence. According to the philosopher, God in some way is related or connected, but not in a way that he inserts himself within that time-based reality. God gains no new knowledge. He doesn't forget, nor does he gain new knowledge. If we are constantly doing things that are new and are different from what we did yesterday, then God cannot possibly have any new knowledge of what is going on, because that would suggest that God is in some way changeable and mutable and given to the changes of time. That again is a description of an imperfect God, not a perfect God. Now, how does Judaism approach that? You know, we mentioned last week that one of the mysteries that we would have difficulty answering is why God created us in the first place. We don't really understand it so well, other than to state that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to do something kind for his creations, and so therefore he created us and gave us a beautiful world, which is filled with gifts. But we still don't understand how God's essence could have changed in such a way in that at some point he just made a decision to do something that wasn't there before. So we really don't understand, and that's one of the things that we had said, that a person is not supposed to contemplate or speculate about what existed before the creation, because it leaves one in a state of some level of confusion. But this question, I think, perhaps is a little bit easier for us to address, because it discusses God in the here and now. Is God capable of gaining new knowledge of the human experience? And if so, does that suggest that God is different today from the way God was before, from the way that he was yesterday? So this has many this has many different approaches to it, and it even hinges on the question that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi will tackle head-on, but not until the end of the book, which is the question of determinism, of God's foreknowledge, of God's ability to know things before they're going to happen, and how that can be reconciled with human free will. The determinism versus free will issue is a very big issue in medieval philosophy, and it's something that we will encounter in the Kuzari as well. The Rambam's approach to this is really just to say that it's, again, one of these mysteries that we'll never fully understand, how it is that God can know everything that's going to happen before it happens, and yet still allow for human beings to choose freely whatever they would like to do. But it seems almost from here that the philosopher's challenge, or the philosopher's assertion about God, that God has no knowledge about what is going on in the human experience, in our human world, in our physical world, almost begs the answer. God has foreknowledge. God does exist outside of time. It exists outside of space. And therefore, he has the capability of knowing all that has, is, and will occur simultaneously. That's the Jewish response, is that it is the very fact that God is outside of space which allows him to see everything spread out before him achronologically, without a chronology, without a timeline. That in Judaism is a very humbling piece of information. The reason why it's a humbling piece of information is because for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he is looking at us in this room at the very same moment that he's looking at Akedas Yitzchak, at our ancestor Avraham Avinu, doing the ultimate sacrifice to Hashem. So that when we try to think about, you know, who we are, you know, of course we console ourselves by saying it's a crazy world out there. So, you know, the very fact that we can actually commit ourselves to come to a shir on a regular basis means that I'm a little bit ahead of the game, right? But at the same time, it's humbling to think that for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, our reality is a false reality. The real reality is everything is happening at the same time. All of human history is happening simultaneously for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and so therefore the martyrs of the Shoah and the martyrs of all other prior massacres and the Churban Beis HaMikdash and the Kedas Yitzchak, and all of these events are all happening simultaneously. They're all unfolded before Hashem all at the same time, all of human history. So that we're there we are, right there next to Avraham and Yitzchak. So we have to think to ourselves, on the one hand, yes, it's true, we are way ahead of the game if we're comparing ourselves to what's going on in the world today. But at the same time, let's also remember that and for Hashem's perspective, there really is no, it's not relative, it's all absolute. So that is a very humbling idea. Okay, so that's, of course, then he says, God does not hear your prayers or see your movements. And therefore, prayer is purposeless for the philosopher. There's no point in praying to a God who's not listening, is not mindful. We are puny creations. God is well elevated above anything that is existing in a temporal, physical-based universe. It's just, therefore, there's no point in connecting on an active level and trying to communicate to a God who has no frame of reference. There's no conduit between ourselves and God that can allow for prayers to ascend to heaven. That doesn't exist for the philosopher, and that's a philosophical reality for the philosopher. It's not just a rhetorical argument that is appealing to our emotions, but it's a logical argument that states that it's philosophically or logically impossible for Hashem to be listening, because God is such a being of such perfection that he does not attend to our imperfect universe. Okay, so that's the argument in a nutshell. Anyone want to question that or comment on that? We also have problems with prayer in Judaism. There are plenty of questions about prayer that we can discuss. I don't know if this is the right place to discuss all of the questions about prayer, but if God is a perfect being and an all-knowing being, then we have another question about prayer, which is, what's the point of praying to a God who already knows what I need? God already knows what those needs are. And so therefore, tefillah is not just a way of waking up God and informing him of things that we are needful of, but rather a way of arousing ourselves to the things that we are needful of. Let's also keep that in mind when we talk about God hearing our prayers or seeing our movements. The movements that we make in our worship of Hashem really do not affect HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God is elevated above any kind of being affected by the things that we can do in this world, whether through prayer or through Maaseh HaMitzvot, the actions that we perform. We agree with the philosopher on that account. There is a certain logic to what the philosopher is saying. And yet we still believe that there is meaningfulness and purpose to our prayers and to our movements, because despite the fact that God is elevated above being affected by these things, he wants us to be affected by them. And he is gratified by the fact that we are elevating ourselves in the process of doing something that is, in effect, worshiping Hashem. Okay, yes, please.
There is a place for questions. But philosopher does believe that God exists and created the world.
Well, those are two different questions. You want to divide those in half? Does God exist and did God create the world?
Too elevated. Believe that God is too elevated. It means he is somewhere there.
God exists. But whether God created the world is a question that we're going to get to shortly.
And if he doesn't see your movement, it means there is no punishment or reward.
There cannot be punishment or reward. There cannot be reward or punishment for the philosopher. So this is what we would call hardcore apikorsis. This is really hardcore heresy for the Jew, because there are three basic foundational beliefs that every Jewish theologian needs to subscribe to. And this is whether or not a person is Maimonidean and being dogmatic about other principles of faith or not. There are three basic common denominators that we all believe in. Number one, that God exists. Number two, that there is a God. God is providential, which means he is mindful of what is going on in this world, and that he is capable of bringing reward and punishment. And number three, or sometimes people switch two and three, is that he made known to us what his wishes are, what he wants, what he expects of us. And so, and that was through the giving of the Torah. So those are foundational beliefs. Once we argue that God is not mindful of what's going on down here, then there is no judge, there is no justice, and it's just a free-for-all. And therefore, for the philosopher, the purpose of life is not to serve a higher being, because the higher being cannot be served by us. We are too removed and too puny to be able to serve a higher being. There is no benefit to the higher being, but rather the purpose of existence is self-perfection. We don't deny that in Judaism. We also affirm that the reason why God created us was because he wanted to allow us to become as perfect as possible. But the way that he did so was to tell us, serve me and that will perfect you.
But what is the purpose of God for philosopher? What is the purpose of idea of God for philosopher?
The purpose is to attach yourself to the most perfect being of existence, and in that way you gain immortality. That's the function. The function of, well, there has to be a God. Look, let me explain something. And it goes back to the real question that you're asking. Why does a philosopher need to believe in God? It's impossible for the world to exist without there being some intelligence that is ordering and making sure that the system is working. That's the medieval belief before the advent of a certain kind of revolution that took place sometime in the 17th century, with the advent of certain scientific discoveries as well as certain new philosophical models. Up until the 17th century, when you had the Newtonian revolution with Sir Isaac Newton telling us that it's possible for the universe to operate by itself like a clock, human beings could not conceive of a world where the sun rises in the east and sets in the west without there being some form of, the fancy word is teleology, or some kind of sentience that runs the universe. The universe cannot function without there being someone making sure that the trains are running on time. How is it that everything is moving the way it's supposed to move? The world and its human civilization did not conceive of this concept of gravity and centrifugal force that allows bodies, these huge celestial bodies, to move up there, you know, basically automatically. Comes along Isaac Newton in the 17th century, and he says, you guess what? You don't need God for the planets to move, and, you know, or for the sun to go around the earth. The sun can go around the earth just fine on its own. Well, and the reason I say that is because this is also around the time when we discover that it's not the sun going around the earth, but the earth going around the sun. And the whole world is in tremendous upheaval, because of all of these new discoveries that are taking place. And the most dramatic sort of new piece of information that we gain in this new world that we enter into in the 17th century is not so much that the Earth is not the center. We can live with that, but it's what's much more dramatic is the fact that you don't need God to run the world. The world can run just fine on its own. And that's something that that Jewish thinkers have never acknowledged. And it was not only that, but we have canonized in our liturgy. And I use the word canonized deliberately because the only way to canonize something in Judaism is either make it part of a biblical text or to make it part of tefillah. Because once it becomes part of tefillah, then it can't be changed. Because our davening is our davening. It's been that way ever since it was instituted, right? Many, many centuries ago. And so what do we say in our davening? We say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Mechadesh B'tuvo B'chol Yom Tamid Ma'aseh V'Reshit. And God constantly renews on a daily basis the act of creation. Well, this was everyone's belief. This was not just what Jews believed. This was what the whole world believed, that because the world couldn't exist without there being someone running the show. How else does the sun always know how to come up in the east and set in the west? And how else do plants and blades of grass know how to grow? Right? There must be some force, this sentience throughout the universe, that is guiding things along. So philosophers clearly acknowledge that there has to be some higher force, some ultimate one unitarian force that is guiding and controlling everything. The debate becomes not does God exist, but what is the nature of God, and what is his relationship with the world that is so dissimilar to him? Yes? Okay? Yes?
So the philosopher has just said that God is perfect, is not lacking in anything, but it seems like in this next sentence he contradicted himself, because it sounds to me like the philosopher has said that because God is not temporal, that he's incapable of acquiring knowledge about us, he's incapable of hearing our prayers.
That's a very good question, and it's going to boil down to perhaps a semantical argument. You know, one of the big questions that you learn when you take philosophy in school is to ask silly questions. And so one of the silly questions that we used to ask is, can God create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift? Right? So, do you ever hear that question before?
Yeah.
No? So think about it. If you've never heard it before, think about it for a second. Can God create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift? If the answer is that he can create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift, then it means that he is not omnipotent, because there's something that he cannot do. He can't lift the rock. And if he can't create the rock, then he's also not omnipotent, because he can't create something. So what's the answer to the question? To this, you know, to this sort of philosophical tautology, you know, this sort of thing that folds in on itself. The answer is that it's really a semantical impossibility. It's to boil down that sentence is to basically say that God is incapable of imperfection. To say that God is incapable of imperfection is part of the definition of his being perfect. Do you understand that? So imperfection equals temporality. So God cannot, by the nature of his perfection, lower his stature to become imperfect and insert himself in an imperfect existence. It would be the same thing as saying, can God create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift? Am I making sense?
Yes. Okay. I did take philosophy.
right. Yeah, okay. Right. Okay. So let's let's go on to number 9.
When philosophers say that God created you, which would imply that he knows about you, this is not to be taken literally. What is meant is that God is the ultimate source of all that exists, but not that God deliberately created you. God never created man. Rather, the universe has always existed. Man has always existed, constantly being born from a previous generation and a previous generation from the one before it, and so on.
Okay, so therefore, philosophers only use the borrowed term that God created you. Philosophers don't believe that God created anything. Everything has always existed because, as we mentioned before, creation is a philosophical impossibility for God. And therefore, and God's knowledge of you is also a philosophical impossibility. Everything has always existed. This is pure Aristotelianism. This is something that the church never entertained. It's something that I don't believe that a true Muslim could ever possibly entertain, but it's something that the Islamic philosophers of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's age and leading up to his age did subscribe to, because it was from the writings of Aristotle. Aristotle felt that he could prove that the universe has eternally existed by virtue of the fact that perfection is immutable, perfection is essentially unchanging. And therefore, if God is the source of all that has always existed, then there must be some immutability about existence in general. So everything's always existed the way it is now. Nothing essentially changes. It's almost like anti-Darwinian, like nothing evolves, nothing changes. Yes? It's important to know that Aristotle was a very, very brilliant man. The Rambam had tremendous admiration for him, but he got so much wrong because he didn't use what became later known as the scientific method. Scientific method basically states that you can assert a theory, but then you have to test the theory. Aristotle only did these things in his mind. He only came up with these logical conclusions by speculation. And the difference between philosophy and science, what eventually changed essentially with this Newtonian revolution in this new era, is that people stopped being philosophers and basically said, we have to be able to test in the laboratory all the things that sound to us to be logically true. One of the things that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is going to argue later on is that your mind only gets you so far, because there are so many convincing arguments to go against the Torah. But that doesn't mean that the Torah is illogical. It just means that there are two logical paths that one can take. One can take a logical path that leads him to the Torah's account of God and creation, and one can also take another equally logical and cogent path of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato to come to the conclusion that, you know, God is, you know, the universe is godless or does not have a God that interacts with it, that there was no revelation and that there was no Maimon Har Sinai. And there's no reason to choose one logical path over the other. And therefore, since you have two equally viable logical paths to take, choose the one that involves a tradition. The path that involves tradition is the much more reasonable path to take, because you have a whole line of huge populations of people that have passed down a tradition to us from generation to generation. I think a very crucial point that hopefully we'll revisit when we get to that portion of the Kuzari, and that is that in trying to debate the issues of the virtues of the, you know, the logic of Judaism, I don't think that one can say that being an atheist is less logical than being a theist. In other words, a person is not less intelligent just because they don't believe in God. And that, therefore, it sometimes becomes a losing battle if you take that presumption that people who don't believe in God are less intelligent or don't have good arguments to make. Their path has always been as equally logical as a belief in God. Right? The only difference is that what makes more sense is to follow a path that humankind has subscribed to for centuries, because it's logical to assume that there were very smart people that came before us. The reason why atheists poo-poo that is because they say, oh, there were people were just a bunch of superstitious you know, primitives who were, you know, painting themselves blue and running around trees and going ooga booga. But we don't believe that. We believe that, yes, it's true that people's worldviews were different back then. They didn't have scientific knowledge the way that we have it today. They didn't, certainly they didn't understand that the universe could run mechanistically, that it could run on its own like a clock that was wound up at the beginning of time and just run itself down. But that's not to say that they were completely naive and completely unaware of certain phenomena that were going on around them. And if there was a whole nation of people or nations of people that were professing that there were revelations and there were miracles, you can take a cynical approach and say that these people were just being easily fooled and too gullible and didn't realize that these were natural phenomena. Or you could take a more reasoned approach, which is to say that it's unlikely that an entire nation said that they saw the splitting of a Red Sea if that splitting never took place. It's unlikely that an entire nation of people said that they were witness to a revelation of God at Mount Sinai if that revelation never took place. Those are the arguments, I think, that are the most convincing. And I learned this from the Kuzari. We're not here to try and say that atheists and non-believers are foolish. We're here to argue that, no, they're very intelligent. Their arguments are just as good as ours from a logical standpoint, but we have something that they will never have, which is Misora. We have tradition. Yeah? Okay. Let's go on.
The human being is composed of spiritual abilities, physical characteristics, and personality traits inherited from his parents and his relatives. Environment also plays a role in a person's physical and emotional makeup. Air quality, geography, and food and water specific to the region. Also the planets, stars, and other celestial bodies all radiate various influences upon the individual.
Okay, well, based on what we've just said, if God is not involved in the creative process on a regular basis, God is not even knowledgeable of what is going on, and people are just constantly being born, and there's an infinite chain of existence going back all the way back to infinity, then how did I get the way I am, and how did you get the way to be the way you are? And that's all a product of environment. It's a product of genetics, although he doesn't use that terminology. He uses air quality, geography, food and water specific to the region, the planets, the stars, and other celestial bodies all radiate various influences upon the individual. There really is no sort of conscious decision by any creator to make you the way you are. It's true that you possess a soul. Aristotle will grant you that. You possess a soul. And you possess certain features that are non-physical within you, such as your intellect. And how intelligent you're going to be, though, however, is based just purely on the roll of the dice, based upon when you were born, what time you were born, what country you were born in, who your parents were, et cetera, et cetera. There is no conscious decision of God to say, I'm going to take this holy neshamala from this very holy repository in heaven and insert it in that person and give him those characteristics. This is very, very clearly dramatically different from the Jewish belief that, as various midrashim point out, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides with tremendous precision exactly how a person is going to be. As a matter of fact, there's a Gemara that says that before you were born, HaKadosh Baruch Hu even showed you what you were going to be like before you were born. He said, your neshama is going to enter into a body, and this is what you're going to look like, this is what you're going to be like, these are going to be your characteristics. And you had to actually endorse your creation before Hashem would allow you to be born. So this is the medrash that says that. That's a very powerful medrash. Talk about that another time. But it also should give a person pause to think about that medrash any time you feel, oh, I'm too ugly, I'm too this, I'm too that, I'm miserable with my life. Just think that before you were born, Hashem showed you all the circumstances that would occur in your life, and you actually had to endorse that life before Hashem would allow you to be born. So, and Hashem decided with tremendous, tremendous precision what you were going to be like, and what characteristics you would have, what your intelligence quotient would be, what your capabilities would be, whether you'd be tall or short, or stocky or thin, or all of these other things. HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided everything, and you knew about it before you were born. And you said, okay, it's a deal, Hashem. If this is the way you want me to be, you think this is the best way for me to be, I accept that. Personality level too.
So people actually would say, okay, to not be nice then? Yeah. How
that? Well, I mean, that's not niceness has to do with bechira.
Okay, nice, honest.
Niceness and honest, all the things that have to do with moral behavior, those are all products of our bechira chofshi. Those are all product of how we choose to exercise our free will. Even Esav could have been a good guy. He had certain character traits that made him more prone to being aggressive. But aggressiveness is not a negative. Aggressiveness is a neutral. If Esav would have decided to become a librarian, that would have been a disaster. You understand? Esav needed to be out in the field. He needed to be doing things. If someone would have forced Esav to be a librarian, he would have gone postal one day and would have ended up killing someone who brought in an overdue book. Right? But that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Esav with, the tendencies of aggressiveness. How he chose to use those aggressive tendencies was his, of his own making. Yeah? Yes?
I mean, we have to be on a much higher level to accept, for some of us to accept the life of poverty or life of hardship.
Precisely.
Because today, I mean, who would...
who would make that decision? Of course not. You know, the Zohar talks about this extensively, and the Ishbitzer Rebbe was very big into this whole concept of the preordination of the way God had originally made things. That, you know, people are today, but even if we are in a state of poverty or some other kind of disadvantage in life, a physical handicap, chas v'shalom, and things like that, everything was preordained according to the Ishbitzer. And he even points out from the Zohar that that the Kohen, who is precluded from doing the avodah, who is precluded from serving in the temple because he has a physical handicap, is far holier than the Kohen Gadol who enters into the temple, into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. And why is that? Because it's easy. It's easy to be holy when you've got to go into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur. It's far more difficult and far more gratifying, ultimately, to be holy when you have to be outside the Holy of Holies. He makes an interesting point. He says, that's why, when I think I've mentioned this in one of my drushes, I don't know if anyone remembers, but I mentioned the moon. The moon is fullest when it is furthest away from the sun. Just thinking about it from an astronomical point of view, the sun is here, the earth is here, and so the moon is at its darkest point when it's closest to the sun, between the earth and the sun. When is the moon fullest? When it's furthest away from the sun, vis-a-vis the earth, in relation to the earth. So what does that tell you about life? That life, you can shine the most when you're furthest away from the light, when you're furthest away from Hashem. That's the way Hashem made the world. And therefore, he made us with these imperfections, and he reassured us that your flaws that I'm going to create you with are going to enable you to soar higher than people who are more perfect than you, who have greater gifts than you. And that's an amazing answer. We can go on about this for all day. That'll be another topic for another time. Okay, enough kuzari for today.